Morning.
Morning.
As many of you know, we've been going through the seven principles, and this being the third principle, I was reminded as I began to read the third principle in a way differently than I have before, because whenever you think you have to put 20 minutes to a principle, you have to think about it a bit differently sometimes. And I was also reminded that an experience of when I first attended seminary, Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, just before going to that seminary, I was in a group of folks, and we were pretty conservative, fundamentalist Christian types, and I was pretty aggressive, I guess, in a way, because I knew the truth, and I was going to promote the truth, but yet some of my colleagues and friends said, "Don't go there, that's where the demons are," Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. And let me tell you, if you're a Baptist, you can't be anything but somewhat conservative. But this group was pretty, and they told me to go to Dallas Theological Seminary and such. What happened when I went there, I was so excited about going to study about God and Jesus and theology and such. Well, I didn't meet demons, I actually meant angels. But I attended the theology class, and I was excited. But they didn't talk about theology or the person of Jesus for a whole nother semester. They talked about first things. They talked about different understandings of the term God throughout the ages. They talked about a variety of theologies. They put five theologies up on the board, one in which I thought was the absolute truth, but four others that made a whole lot of sense to me too. So I went into my own crisis at that point. That was good. Even then, that was good. But what occurred to me and what that taught me was that no matter what my belief is or whatever I say, there are things that come before. And the third principle says that we have acceptance for one another. Well, there is something that comes before the acceptance of one another, and that is self-acceptance. Without self-acceptance, there is no acceptance of the other. And I think that is something that comes before we need to pay attention to. And I think the work we have done on the first two principles, we go back for a minute and remind ourselves, on the first principle, we talked about the inherent dignity and worth of persons. And again, there we talked about, do we have self-dignity? We went through a three-part understanding of standing with dignity, speaking with dignity, and understanding with dignity, and what that meant. And I was fascinated with that idea of understanding with dignity, and I think an example of that would be if I went to that theological class, Theology 101, and I saw a variety of theologies up on the board, and I was, say, afraid to embrace the other perspectives, even though I knew they made sense and had just as much validity and actually some more so than the one I believed in, if I would have still believed in that first theology that I committed myself to, and I would have throughout my ministerial career affirmed that theology, knowing that it kind of wavered, that is not understanding with dignity. Understanding with dignity is when I learn something different other than what I believe and I recognize there's some truth to it, then I need to address that other truth and I need to integrate that other truth to what I am and how I speak. That's understanding with dignity, that I don't have all the answers. And then during the second principle we looked at, We understood from looking at the life of Buddha and the work and the ministry of Buddha that there are jail keepers within our inner worlds. There are jail keepers in our inner worlds, which I call the inscape of who we are, the place where our history is stored, the place where our narrative is stored, the place where we make meaning, the place of how we understand who we are. Within that inscape, within that narrative that I have within myself that makes up who I am, there are jail keepers. And when we looked at that a little more, we, as the teachings of Buddha taught us, those jail keepers, or that final jail keeper that Buddha struggled with, prevents the full expression and the full feeling of compassion. And then when that happens, we move into a state of denial about some things in life. And particularly we looked at that point in relationship to justice. And we recognize that if I come to some kind of balance in my life where that jail keeper still has life, and that jail keeper, I'm going to say, it's okay if you live within my end scape. And what I mean by that is, I can remember about 15 years ago, I was doing counseling with this person, and this person came into my counseling office, and she said to me, we can talk and we can work on anything but that. Well, what she was telling me was that there's a jail keeper there. There's something inside her that was keeping a part of her at bay, not available for the conversation. There's jail keepers within us, and when that denial happens, sometimes we miss the injustices of the world. Sometimes we are numbed out to the injustices of the world. Full sense of compassion goes along with a full sense of justice. And if I have jail keepers in my life, those parts of myself that do not allow me to go into particular parts of my history, or whenever I hear somebody telling a story or somebody asking me questions, I block that question or those stories from touching that part of who I am that I have boxed up, that I have locked up, that I have put aside. As I understood the teachings of Buddha, that will put me in a state of denial to some injustices, and I won't see some injustices. More importantly, I think, it diminishes my capacity of empathy. And as we talked about last time I was here, that capacity of empathy, that of what that means to be human, we need to have the capacity of empathy to even sit with those who are being tortured, to even sit with those who are doing the torturing. Our sense of empathy needs to mature to the place where we can sit with those things that we detest and come to terms with that and recognize quite possibly in all of us are those things we detest. And when I move through my shadow side and when I move through those things, it's at that point that I think the teachings of Buddha and the teachings of Jesus teach us that indeed we can have a full sense of capacity, that capacity of empathy and compassion. These are the things, these are the understandings that we bring to bear upon the third principle. We don't come to the third principle as if it is an independent statement, as if it is an independent belief. We come to the third principle knowing that it is part of who we are as a people, and it is connected to a whole, and it is another perspective on the whole that it is connected to. The third principle, first things we must do is accept ourselves. We must come to terms with who we are. And I'm going to suggest today that shame is the greatest hindrance to accepting ourselves. That shame diminishes the capacity of who we are as human beings. And that shame's hard to get a hold of. What does it mean? We know it, sometimes it's a feeling. We also know that we do a lot of things not to feel shame. Shame is that drive that drives addictions. Shame is that drive that drives self-destructive behaviors. Shame is that drive that drives racism. Shame is that drive that drives a sense of superiority. Shame is that drive that sets us apart from ourselves as well as others. Shame is something that must be faced if we are going to incorporate the meaning of the third principle within ourselves. And in order to do that, we must have an understanding of what shame is. Shame, as different from guilt, shame has a sense of incapacitating us, overpowering us. Shame is related to feelings of inferiority, submissiveness, being smaller than. Shame is associated with a sense of weakness. It is associated with senses of rage and fury. Shame does not seek reconciliation. Shame is absolute. Shame is that feeling state in which we function when we say we know the truth and you don't. Shame does not seek reconciliation. Shame prevents us from being a community that is an emotionally safe community, that is a healing community. Shame says that when you don't come to church two or three times, that you don't want to come back because of what others might think. Shame is acutely aware of what others think about us, even when they're not thinking it. Shame is the core of what we project from ourselves that we don't like onto others, and we believe others say something about who we are that is negative, when quite possibly they don't even have that belief and they're not saying that at all. Shame will help us distort reality. Shame will move us away from who we are, and shame will prevent us from self-acceptance and self-affirmation. For 100 years or so, we have been taught by some, I think, the brightest and the best minds in Western civilization, and that's a big statement, but I think it's true, and I think those folks are the philosophers and theologians. And the philosophers and the theologians, for the past 100 years or so, have been fighting, recognizing that we human beings in Western civilization are beginning a process in which we objectify ourselves as things, in which we become commodities for sale. These theologians and these philosophers recognized that something was happening in our culture where we could begin the process of using one another without regard for our humanity. One in particular that I like and has helped me try to understand this is a fellow by the name of Paul Tillich. And one reason why I like Paul Tillich and theologians of his era was that these theologians came through World War I, came through World War II, and then began to write and to teach after that. These theologians knew a demonic power. These theologians knew the total disregard for a people. These theologians understood what it meant to scapegoat, dehumanize, in order to solidify another group to power. Paul Tillich says that the way that we can escape this dehumanizing and this objectification of ourselves is what something that he calls having absolute faith. Absolute faith is something that grips us in a world that we can come to the conclusion of there really is no meaning. We just exist and we die, and there's no meaning in death. There really is no purpose in life. There's nothing other than the short span of time that we're in. And he teaches that absolute faith somehow moves through that sense of meaninglessness, moves through that sense of apathy, moves through that sense of shame, and can create a vitalness, a vitality in us that moves us back toward life. But absolute faith connects us with something. Absolute faith connects us with which helps me understand is the river of life that travels through time. In a Unitarian Universalist tradition, an absolute faith would bring us to the place where Emerson, Thoreau, Margaret Fuller become alive in us, that we can own our tradition and our tradition lives within us. That we can own the Socinian community that we've talked about before that gave birth to our value system and that claim freedom and that claim tolerance for who we are. Absolute faith connects us to the larger river in life that's bigger than us. We're in a culture now, and the psychoanalytical community teaches us that in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, the feeling state that we struggled with was a feeling of guilt. 60s, 70s, and 80s, that same community said, now we are beginning to struggle with the feeling of shame. We are beginning to struggle with the feeling of shame, and what shame does is it drives our truest self away and then we have to create ourselves as with shame being the foundation. And I got to thinking about that, and I've thought about that through the years, and I got to thinking about that in terms of today. What would move me to objectify myself today? And I got to thinking, when I get on the computer and I go searching around the computer, there's this thing called cookies. And these cookies go through the computer and land in my computer, and they communicate to somebody else what I'm up to and what I like. And they begin to coordinate a personality understanding of who I am, and that begins to coordinate a presentation to me of what I like. And because I like it, I have more affinity to it. And as I have more affinity to it, I reveal more information about myself. And as I reveal more information about myself, there's a continued construction of who I am, so that what's presented to me in the commercial world is something that people will feel I'll be seduced to moving into. We live in an era of time where we hear the government, we hear other agencies are just continually grabbing material and information about who we are. And they're using that information, and they're using that to manipulate who I am, who we are. And indeed, are we becoming just a number? I don't know if you've seen that movie, The Matrix, where there's wires hooked up and they're draining energy from people, but the people are dreaming stuff that's pleasant to them. It's a good world to them, while they are being used to bring comfort and power to somebody else. If I give way to that world somebody is creating for me that I have an affinity for, because they realize the things that I like in life and that I'm vulnerable to, and I begin to submit myself to that presentation of whatever those images are, whoever put those images out there, that I begin to commit myself and transform myself into that image, I have lost myself. The key ingredient to shame is a sense of helplessness. And when I'm in a world that spends billions of dollars manipulating me to be other than who I am, I often feel helpless. When I watch the things in the media communication that I know are deceiving, and yet I know I feel like I can't do anything about it, and I feel helpless. According to the understanding of shame, it means I'm moving into a place of shame because I feel powerless. On the piece of paper that says, Wednesday evening, soup and study. Talk to Bob Watkins. On the back of that, there's a diagram. And when we talk about accepting others and encouragement of spiritual growth within our congregations, first, we need to accept ourselves and struggle with that. Second, we need to figure out what encouragement is as opposed to intrusiveness, as opposed to pestering people to spiritual growth. We need to know the difference between encouragement and bothering. And at the same time, I'm also suggesting that our spiritual journey and promoting spiritual growth within our congregations is more than just about the inscape. It's more than just about who we are within ourselves. And I think those first three principles really point us to dealing with what's going on inside of ourselves. After those first three principles, we see a gradual moving outside of ourselves. Okay. As a result of that, if you look on that diagram, I have that there is a spiritual agenda with who we are within ourselves. There is a spirituality with who we are in relationship with the primary people in our family. There is a spirituality with who we are as we relate to the society at large. There is a spirituality as we relate to our culture at large. And there is a spirituality as we go beyond our culture into nature, in which we relate to nature. And I got to thinking about, I don't like to be encouraged to even think about or contemplate or reflect on certain areas of those spirituality. I get tired of hearing about that cultural element. I get tired of hearing about go inward and wrestle with that jailkeeper. And I'm going to suggest whatever one we're tired of hearing about may be the area we need to focus on in our spiritual growth. A thought. Sooner or later, we need to be available for encouragement. Not that our community, our congregation encourages us, but I take the responsibility in my freedom and bring myself to a place where I can experience encouragement to spiritual growth, where I can wrestle with the sense of shame that is in this culture, and I think that this culture would move us to, because shame decapacitates us. I need to bring myself to a place where I can hear feedback and confrontation about who I am in a gentle way, not in a harsh way. When we do that, when we work with those things that we can begin to accept ourselves and become self-affirming within a community, when we begin to make ourselves available for encouragement for our spiritual growth as individuals and as members of a community, we will begin to recognize that we have the authority to write our own story and to make meaning ourselves. That we have the authority to do that. Not that we accept the authority of somebody else to drive my life, which is based on shame. And what I mean by that is, let's say that at 3, 4, 5, 8 to 10 years old, I had a father who, whenever I wanted to make contact with him, was a bit distant. So I would figure out ways to try to get him to affirm me, cutting the grass, cleaning up, whatever that, doing good in sports, doing good in school, whatever that might be. I would actually abandon, not knowing this is what I'm doing, abandon my natural path of development and growth. I will take a detour and step off that path and begin to move in the direction of seducing affirmation from somebody to validate and value who I am as a person. When that happens, somebody else begins to make meaning for me, and I begin to submit my life to that meaning and live out my life seeking that affirmation that was deprived of me. That is an example of how that works. Spiritual growth is reclaiming that place where you were and you're growing in your spiritual development and standing back there, recognizing the detours we've taken and understanding the detours we've taken. Because each detour we take, there may be a jailkeeper that stops us from getting back on what's healthy for us. Sometimes the jailkeeper is powerful, sometimes the jailkeeper is not so powerful. But they are there, and they will have an attempt to stop us from getting back on that path for health. When we move through those blocks, when we move through those hindrances and move through that shame to get back on that path of who we are as healthy human beings, we begin to make meaning for ourselves. We confront that sense of meaninglessness if it is there, and we begin to recognize that meaning is more than who I am. Meaning is about being in community. Meaning is accepting that I may be important to others. And if I am important to others, I have a responsibility there. If I've isolated myself so I'm not in relationships, so others aren't important to me and I'm not important to them, then I need to deal with that. That third principle says we need to get off the detour and come back home. It says that we need to be available for spiritual encouragement, and I need to take the responsibility to make myself available for spiritual encouragement. It is at that point that I can understand what it means to be part of a spiritual community that's growing and that's different, and that we participate in making meaning together, not accepting external value, external meaning, but together struggling and making meaning for ourselves. And we make meaning for ourselves as a result of understanding what's happening in the here and now, what's happening today, not what happened yesterday, not what we believe is going to happen in the future. To make meaning today, we must understand the injustices of today. We must understand the justices of today. We must understand what's happening in the here and now. If we allow history and if we allow our thinking about the future to impinge upon the here and now, so that when I interpret what's happening in the here and now, I distort what's happening in the here and now, I am no longer making meaning for myself, and I have actually stepped away from self-acceptance. The teachings of Buddha tell us, and his second part of his pilgrimage into his spiritual development was letting go of the past and of the future. We know in our spiritual pilgrimage, letting go of the past and letting go of the future means not allowing the past and not allowing the future to impinge upon the here and now and make meaning for us. When we look back through the history of Unitarian Universalists, one of the things we will find is that they dealt with the here and now issues. They dealt with slavery. They dealt with the persecution in the 1500s. We need to step into the here and now together, as anxious as that might be at times, and interpret what's going on, and understanding how we can implement the values that we adhere to as a community and as individuals. We need to stop sometimes and move within our endscape and become intimately aware of who we are. And at that point, we'll be available to accept others for who they are.